The EPA, when they introduce these rules, they're not contemplating the increased cost to consumers across the country. You know this, but when you look at fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal, it generates approximately 70% of all of our electricity. If you have this war on coal that the EPA is engaged in, and you take about 30 to 35% of that fossil fuel mix off the grid, what is that going to do? It's going to cause rates to skyrocket across the country. And so the president is doing all that he can to make sure that those that least can afford it is going to be paying, they're going to be paying the most for their utility costs.
That's Oklahoma's Attorney General Scott Pruitt on Fox Business last year. He helped coordinate an ongoing lawsuit of 28 states against the Environmental Protection Agency's carbon emissions rules. He has said repeatedly that states themselves should regulate local industries like oil and gas. He said the EPA was wrong to step on those state powers. Well, now Donald Trump is nominating Scott Pruitt to run the EPA. And here to help us understand what that might mean for Los Angeles and for California is Kara Horowitz. She's co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, tell us more about these rules that the 28 states have blocked.
So this is the Clean Power Plan. It's a rule that is a mainstay of President Obama's approach to fighting climate change. It would control climate pollution from existing power plants in the United States, which make up the largest segment of climate pollution sources. It would cut that that climate pollution by about a third by 2030.
And the Supreme Court issued a stay on these rules while this court battle works its way out.
Yeah, that's right. And the court case is now in front of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which has heard oral argument, and we're awaiting a decision.
Okay. Could that decision come before the end of the Obama administration?
It's possible that it could. People speculate that, especially if the court has reached something that looks like a consensus, that it wants to uphold the rule, there might be strategic reasons for it to fast walk the decision out the door before Trump takes office. But I think that would be difficult. There are 10 judges who've heard this case in the D.C. Circuit, and they all have to agree on a set of written outcomes. So I'm not sure we'll really be able to see something before Trump takes office.
And even if the judges do uphold the law, would Scott Pruitt, if he's against it, as he obviously is, would he just not enforce it?
Yeah, I mean, he and EPA have several options. If they want to essentially get rid of the Clean Power Plan, he could decide to cease defending the law in the courts. Even if it's upheld by the D.C. Circuit, I think it's certain to be appealed to the Supreme Court, where, of course, a new Trump nominee would await hearing the fate of the rule. And even at the end of the day, if it's upheld by the courts altogether, EPA could decide that it wanted to re-regulate, sort of reconsider the regulation, or just slow walk enforcement. That's right.
Okay. Well, so assuming that this power plan is pretty much dead at this point, what does that mean for California, for the air and water?
Yeah, so California on climate actually is looking pretty strong and actually pretty prescient. California, more than 10 years ago at this point, passed the first in the nation kind of statewide limit on climate pollution called the Global Warming Solutions Act, and it set a statewide limit for 2020 that we're on pace to meet for climate pollution. And in the last legislative session, actually enhanced our commitment to reducing climate pollution out to 2030. So those limits remain in place no matter who the head of EPA is or who our president is. But it can get much harder to meet those climate commitments in California depending on sort of what the feds are doing. And then as to more traditional pollution, sort of water quality and air pollution control, it really matters what the feds do.
Okay, so tell us more about that in terms of water quality.
Yeah, so for example, under President Obama, EPA has made a series of air pollution and water pollution rules that are more protective of health of the environment. So EPA has tightened the ozone standard. That one is really important for LA because it affects smog levels. It's restricted mercury and other toxics from power plants. As to water pollution, it passed a more sort of aggressive reading of what waters are protected in the United States under the Clean Water Act. It's very clear that Scott Pruitt opposes each of these and that he would consider it his mandate and mission at EPA to roll them back.
And is it simple to do that? Could he just say, we're not going to enforce these rules anymore, or would it be more complicated?
Yeah, it is more complicated. So EPA is constrained by what the Clean Air Act says, so it has to work within statutory limits, and the statute's very clear, at least as to some of those air pollutants, that the regulatory body has to act based on concerns about health and health alone. If EPA wants to re-regulate, it has to produce a sort of clear record of evidence about why it's choosing to reconsider these rules. If the EPA wanted to be a little more stealthy about it, they could just create an environment of lax enforcement, and that might be an easier approach.
So are environmentalists afraid that this is the beginning of the end of the EPA entirely?
So it's true that President-elect Trump on the campaign trail talked about eliminating the EPA entirely. Most people agree he couldn't just do it with a stroke of pen. He would need Congress's cooperation and approval. I think most people think that even in this very partisan era, Republicans would recall that that the EPA was created under a Republican president and really does
Nixon,
have...
Nixon, right?
That's right, Nixon. Really does have bipartisan support across many communities. So getting rid of the EPA entirely, I think, seems extreme even in this extremely partisan era. But Congress has many options short of, you know, disbanding the EPA entirely that could really change the way that air and water quality protection looks in the U.S. So it could severely defund the EPA. It could monkey with provisions of the Clean Air Act, for example, eliminating the ability of the EPA to address climate change entirely is one option on the table.
Now, Los Angeles has some of the worst air quality in the country, if not the worst. And so how could this actually not help in trying to make the air quality better?
Yeah, a lot of communities in Southern California and L.A. really still suffer from tremendously bad air quality. The local air regulators are driven to and required to try and meet federal air quality standards for things like smog and lead and particulate matter, and frankly don't have a great track record of making plans that actually achieve those goals. If the feds make those sort of federal goalposts even more lax, it certainly doesn't mean good things for California air regulation. California does have some tools, both under state law and under federal law currently, to try and ramp up local and state air pollution requirements, and it might turn to those tools increasingly under a Trump administration.
So I imagine there were some phone calls and emails going back and forth among environmentalists about what next, what to do. Is there a strategy?
Sure, there's always a strategy. So, I mean, to the extent that there's any silver lining among progressive communities in the election of Trump, it's really has been a reinvigoration of all sorts of traditional organizing tools and coalitions who are now more determined than ever to make clear what's important to us and to fight for that. In California, we're pretty well positioned on environmental issues. California has been a leader on environmental issues for decades, is well placed to demonstrate and is demonstrating, for example, what climate policies work while growing the economy, and really will play, I think, a key role in continuing to reach out and generate partnerships short of the federal level on those issues.
Well, would there be lawsuits against the EPA?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, California, it's kind of funny. California may now play a role similar to the role that Oklahoma played under Attorney General Scott Pruitt in leading the charge against EPA rollbacks in court.
Oh, okay. And so taking on the rollbacks, taking on not enforcing, for example, this rule or other rules in particular?
Yeah. So, for example, if EPA wanted to reconsider something like the mercury rule, which restricts toxic emissions from power plants, it would have to propose a new rule. It would have to build a record of evidence supporting the rule. And states like California and environmentalists would certainly go to court to oppose the rule if they thought the rule wasn't protective enough of public health.
Kara Horowitz, co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Thank you.
Thanks.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think California should do, could do more to protect the environment, to fight climate change? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. one of those massive homes with columns and a couple of stories looming over a small bungalow in Los Angeles, maybe a Spanish-style bungalow. You can see how these homes could be described derisively as the Hummers of houses. This week, the Los Angeles City Council voted to find new ways to regulate these McMansions. The trend has roots dating back to 2004. That's when residents in Beverly Hills got together to impose restrictions on design standards there. Writer Shea Taifa Mohajer argues in a recent story in Curbed that those restrictions were aimed at a specific kind of design style, pejoratively known as the Persian Palace. And she joins us now to talk about this. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, this is a pejorative, and would you say it's a racist way of describing these homes, Persian palaces?
I think that certainly some of the attitudes against these houses took on a racial tone. And often when a sort of house is othered and treated as being different, it's held to a standard of, you know, whiteness. And the Persians of Beverly Hills were certainly different from the local community there. And standing out drew some ire and soon some coding rules.
Well, describe a typical Persian house.
A Persian home is built for hospitality and for family. Persians typically live multi-generationally, so they tend to be a little bigger. You're going to need more room to entertain if you're going to have four or five families come over for the Persian New Year or for Rosh Hashanah. You're going to want everyone to be able to sit around and say their prayers or read poetry to each other in a large room together. And those weren't the homes that Beverly Hills had, but that was the most desirable zip code. And people wanted to live where there were excellent Jewish schools in this case, and also where the community had already settled.
And Beverly Hills is not known for small houses to begin with. So what was the objection?
You know, not known for small houses, not known for elegant tastes, frankly. So the objections, I think, were really to put a community in their place. And the reasons that those houses were built that way, the columns, for example, they harken back to centuries old palaces in Iran. Yes, so the Persian palace pejorative might have been a joke, but people did love those columns because they represented the kings that were generous and kind and tolerant in eons past, and people that frankly no longer existed, and they had fled a very different country to come to America to build their own happiness.
Well, I guess some people would argue that if you come to America, you should try to assimilate, and that part of that assimilation is adhering to locally accepted standards of taste.
Certainly. Right? And I think that's true. But also, you know, everyone has a right to, you know, be free in America and to express themselves and to have their own concepts of beauty. American standards, you know, are based in Puritanism, and some of them, you know, especially when you have wealth to express, I think can seem not grand enough by some standards. It's certainly not the homes that I was raised in. It's certainly not how I was raised. But if we're interested in freedom, and if we're interested in allowing for aesthetics that represent cultural identity, then I think there are some allowances. And frankly, maybe if they had been better understood, they would have been better tolerated. But they weren't understood, and they were mocked and treated poorly, which is a shame.
And so what's happened to them? Are they still there?
They are still there, but no one is really building new Persian palaces anymore. They aren't particularly the style for young Persians or Iranian Americans, as we're better known. And they've basically been outlawed in most areas in Southern California and through rules that are very similar to Beverly Hills is.
And the rules, do they actually specifically target Persian style houses?
Yeah, so part of the problem was that Beverly Hills did have very free code. You could build out to the lines, but Persians never broke the rules to build the Persian palaces. They went by existing rules, and they were disliked for it. So they had to build new rules that would dial back how much space you can take up on your parcel of land. And also there were rules about window size, door size, which limit things like columns and other sort of things on the front of the house that Persians use as decor, and that were sort of looked down upon, like the Italianate style, the columns.
What about lions?
I think lions are everywhere in Southern California. Yeah. The Persians can't claim those.
Well, what do you make of this new rule or this new attempt at changing the rules in Los Angeles that was passed by the city council yesterday? I mean, do you think that that is also an attack on Persian residents?
Oh, no, it couldn't possibly be. I think that we just have to be aware that sometimes with these rules, there is, you know, an insidious sort of argument behind them, and that we have to be aware of cultural differences when these rules are being drafted, because it's very rare that a minority population has a voice in these conversations and gets heard and gets respected and alters sort of the prevailing way.
So you are a young Iranian-American, and what is the attitude towards these homes, these Persian-themed homes that still exist? Is there a feeling of acceptance or shame or what?
I think that a lot of young Persian-Americans, a lot of young Iranian-Americans look at those houses with a sense of open shame, and it's a pity, because I think that, you know, as generations are born here and are raised here, they understand even less the links that go back to the old country and why people who came from Iran wanted to build them that way. And that's what my story explored. You know, and I didn't like the Persian palaces. I thought they were really unattractive and poor taste. And then I started digging around, and it seemed like maybe it was one of those things that people felt like was an open joke about a people more than it was about a homeowner.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Shaya Taifa Mohajer is a Los Angeles-based writer, and you can read her article about Persian homes at Curbed LA. And we want to hear from you. What do you think the city, the county, what should localities do in terms of putting restrictions on the size and style of houses? You can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Shani Jardin is here for our regular web segment. Get ready. She's going to talk about Donald Trump's Twitter feed. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Once again, President-elect Donald Trump has been tweeting away. Yesterday, the president of the United Steelworkers Union became the target of his trolling. Shani Jardin is here to talk about this and other internet news. She is co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web guru.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm Madeline.
Regular web guru. So he's just tweeting and...
Yeah. Yeah, he's just basically a
pillow.
He's pretty
active on Twitter, and it made me think, well, maybe this is how Twitter will be saved.
Yeah, I really have no idea what the reality is behind Donald Trump's Twitter account, but we do know that he used it in a brand new shocking way yesterday, basically threatening Chuck Jones, head of United Steelworkers 1999, over the carrier labor and
the air conditioning company.
The air conditioning company that was going to move these workers to Mexico. The details of the carrier agreement, the details of Donald Trump's attitudes towards labor have already been well reported elsewhere. But what was shocking about this was that the president-elect of the United States is using a social media platform to intimidate a prominent labor leader over issues that involve, you know, his role as president. It was so shocking also because within hours, the response from Trump's informal troll army on Twitter and on other internet platforms was to threaten Jones. They were calling in death threats.
They were calling him on his flip phone. He has a flip phone.
The guy doesn't even have the ability to read Twitter on his phone. Yeah. And it took him a few hours to realize what kind of a mess he was in.
Well, let's also talk about another powerful Twitter account. And this one is coming out of Aleppo.
Yes.
Aleppo, Syria. And it's in the name of a little girl. I think she's, 7 years old. Her name is Bana Alabed.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are giving this Twitter account attention. Is it real?
We don't know who exactly this person is. It's hard to verify all of what is believed, but basically, Twitter has verified the account. What is verifiable to Twitter isn't necessarily the same thing as what's legit for, say, Press Play or the New York Times or another responsible news organization. But basically, it seems as if this child is the daughter of an activist, a socially woke person, a politically woke person who has somehow managed to survive the war in Syria so far. 26-year-old mom, I think, was the age range. And we're not really clear if this is a kind of a AstroTurf propaganda kind of thing, or like if it is
that the rebels are actually tweeting, or someone in who's in sympathy with them.
Yeah, because in the past, like I can remember back in 2011, there was a big internet scandal when a blogger who purported to be a lesbian in the Middle East, in Damascus, if I remember correctly, turned out to be like a 40-year-old guy here in the United States who had been maintaining this very detailed narrative. And it was sort of heart-wrenching in actually a way that this set off all my alarms when I first saw it. Mm-hmm. But
so how can you tell what's real and what's not?
It's very difficult. And I think that's why these two stories, you know, where we're talking about Donald Trump's use of Twitter and we're talking about this heart-wrenching account of a little child in Aleppo, we're talking about feelings and facts. And one of the limitations of today's internet, today's social media tools, which are media, right? Because more than half of America gets its news through Facebook, that kind of thing. These platforms are built to amplify conversations based on a kind of emotional heat, an emotional intensity. Feelings aren't facts, though. And if platforms that were built to generate the most traffic, the most intensity, the most chatter and excitement and drama and outrage possible, because that's what makes Twitter and Facebook and everybody's Snapchat and everybody else profitable, I feel like it's the responsibility of social media companies like Twitter to take a look at their role in this. Jack Dorsey was asked about this at the Recode conference up in San Francisco this week. Jack Dorsey of Twitter, CEO of Twitter, and he chose his words very carefully, but he said, when asked what he thinks about Donald Trump's use of Twitter, he said his feelings were complicated. That obviously for them, it's very exciting to have this uncensored window into the mind of the man who looks like he's going to become the leader of the free world come January 20th, if not sooner. But at the same time, he's also using this platform to incite hate and to bully individuals.
Well, it's interesting because Twitter's never been more relevant right now or indispensable, because if you want to know what's happening in the mind of the president-elect, you just need to log on to Twitter.
What, wasn't it just maybe 4 or 5 months ago, you and I were sitting here at KCRW, Madeline, saying, oh, Twitter's lost its relevancy.
Right.
What's going to happen? Yeah,
but
well,
you could see if he decides to use another platform, Snapchat, for example.
Yeah, and people have talked about, banning Donald Trump on Twitter. There's this whole, like, change.org petition or something. Petition Twitter to shut down Donald Trump's account. Like, please. He'll just use the next one, or he'll build the Trump app.
Right.
I bet you anything, this time next year, you're going to have me on talking about how the Trump app steals your credit card to make a perpetual donation to the Ivanka Trump fund for sad billionaires' kids.
It would be the MAGA app.
I asked for a dappled pony, not a palomino. Take it back! And get me a non-fat decaf goat milk latte. Stat! That's my Ivanka Trump impression.
That's great.
That's why I'm a blogger.
I've never heard her speak like that.
Yeah.
Shani Jordan, co-editor of OneWorld.net. Thank you.
God help us.
All right, we want to hear from you on Twitter. In fact, do you monitor Twitter to keep up with news stories or with the president-elect? Do you think Twitter should just pull the plug on Donald Trump's account? Let us know on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how did a drum machine that didn't really sound like drums take over popular music?
A lot of, music publications at the time were slating the 808 as essentially the worst thing that ever came on the face of the earth.
The history of the 808, that's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Pop quiz time. What do these three songs have in common?
The Soul Sonic Force, the Big Pow Wow, and MC Chloe.
Healing, baby, is good for me.
Blood in the way you walk.
They are, of course, booty shaking jams, but they're also some of the earliest tracks to use a brand new instrument in the 1980s, the 808 drum machine. The 808 basically created the speaker shattering low end bass flavor of early hip hop and helped launch electronic genres like drum and bass, house, and techno. There's a new documentary out that tracks the rise of the 808 drum machine. It's called 808, of course, and producer Alex Neuer joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so we got a little taste of the 808 there in the lead, but let's play a little bit more, give our listeners a feeling of what it sounds like. Okay, so that is the 808 right there in a song called Hanging on a String. Pick that apart for us, the 808. What's it doing there?
11 sounds that were supposed to sound like a drum didn't quite sound like a drum, and being imperfect turned them into pretty much the inspiration of anything from modern hip-hop to electronic music today, still used, still unmatched, still timeless, and what you hear here from the kick drum that is just this low end, which is boom, uh-huh, boom, to the tinny snare that's just much more high-end, you end up to having a range of sounds that will inspire a change in music in 1980 that essentially can still be felt today and called for a good documentary, I guess, to be made.
And let's not forget the cowbell.
The cowbell, one of my favorite. And similarly, I mean, if we are going to go through the sounds, I will also give a shout to the conga, because Phil Collins, an iconic drummer who we have in the movie, singles it out as his favorite. So I'll also give a shout out to that part.
So the 808 comes on the scene in 1980. Mm-hmm. Is that why it's called the 808?
No. The 808 is purely a technical numbering system that we didn't quite crack, but we just know that it was literally for absolutely no specific reason.
But it was invented or created in Japan.
Indeed.
Give us its bio.
So Mr. Kakehashi, who we got to meet actually in the making of this film, founded Roland in Japan, and they were at a moment where they did a lot of electric organs, and the need to compose beats to go along with the electronic organs was felt. And with the CR78, which had pre-programmed sequences, they started to really see that need amplify. So they really wanted to get into the programmable, the earliest music computers, if you will. You had similar, more expensive devices, such as the Lindrum. The Lindrum was a $5,000 behemoth of a drum machine. It was programmable, and it was perfect, and it was praised. And then Roland, on their limited means, still came about with the 808, with sounds that were criticized for not sounding like a drum machine in 1980.
And who did they build it for? Who were the intended
studios? And it's a studio tool. I mean, the main point was to create tools that would fill gaps in music production. So if you picture independent music producers or all sorts of music producers, they'd need drum machines when they couldn't have a drummer, or they wanted to have something. You can keep the machine going, so you can really work to it. It's a great aid for the production, because you don't have the sort of, perhaps it was early on realizing that they didn't need necessarily the human factor when they just needed a certain beat to just keep playing. It helped writers, it helped guitarists, it helped all sorts of things, and then it pretty much invented a whole new genre music. It was when it was part of the electrofunk emergence in 1980.
And the prime face of that movement is Afrika Bambaataa.
Yes, absolutely. So Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force, the track Planet Rock, the seminal record of what was described as electrofunk. A mixture of what will be more described as modern hip-hop with electronic music, inspiration from Kraftwerk, but as Kraftwerk are insistent, they never used the 808. And
why not?
Because they had all their own tools. They were building those scientific almost orchestras, and they didn't want to be seen as being summarized by a machine.
That's really funny.
And that's why, actually, for example, we couldn't feature their music, because they didn't want to give the misconception that it featured 808, even though our narrative clearly said that they were inspiration. Essentially, the 808 allowed people to get closer to their sound. It sounded futuristic, it sounded odd, and therefore, at the time when Kraftwerk was such an iconic reference for a lot of producers, it just gave a feeling of, okay, I'm one step closer, if you will.
So Afrika Bambaataa embraces the 808.
Mm-hmm.
Did he create his music before the 808? Did he have this idea of what he wanted to do and then the 808 filled that need? Or was it the 808 that shaped his music?
They found an ad in the Village Voice, and some guy was willing to rent out a drum machine, not willing to give his name, not willing to really have much more of an encounter than a meeting in a back alley in New York, taking a cash payment, giving the drum machine, and there you go. The drum machine arrived in the hand of Arthur Baker and John Roby. The beats were produced. And from there, the inspiration that Afrika Bambaataa had from Kraftwerk, but as well as bringing the funk inspiration and the development of Smooth, which was obviously the half-beat kind of rap, all came together and with the technical backing of those guys. The 808 was randomly there. But the sound was spot on. It was perfect. They just, knowing that they had paid maybe $40 to rent it, and it happened to be so iconic, was a beautiful random encounter.
So what was it about the 808? Because as you say, it doesn't sound like a real drum at all. What was it that people really liked about it, besides the fact that it was relatively cheap to use?
The fact that it ended up in certain hands at certain points without really alternatives being available in the similar studios. Whether it is, John and Arthur or Rick Rubin with the Beastie Boys, it was there. And it took everybody a while to really kind of get accustomed to the sound, but the sound sounded different. It was criticized because it didn't sound accurate, and obviously there were a level of expectation that it was supposed to mimic a drum. But in the randomly well-set set of hands at the right time, that sound sounded exactly what it needed to do. And from there, it became really iconic because, of course, when Planet Rock came out, everybody had to have that sound, that unique drum, and the 808 became immediately a must-have and very sought after. And think about the fact that there were only 12,000 units made. It was not easy to get, but it happened to be in many studios in New York.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking to Alex Neuer. He's the executive producer of the new documentary, 808. Now, tell us the story about Marvin Gaye, because he uses little else besides an 808 and his voice on the track, Sexual Healing.
It was a critical point in his career. He wanted to move away from Motown. He had various personal issues, and he wanted to... So he escaped essentially to Belgium. And he showed up to produce some more music with an 808 and a Jupiter 8 synth. So two very not Motown classic pieces of equipment. And he arrived in Belgium, and we got to meet actually the engineer that was randomly contacted to say, hey, by the way, Marvin Gaye wants to record. Here's the equipment. Are you okay to manage this? And he said yes, and we heard the story where pretty much Marvin Gaye had arrived with the 808 pre-programmed, everything, the beats that he wanted, everything was pre-programmed, and it only needed the synth to be laid. So it's a very, very cold method of production. And it was literally, okay, start, wait, stop. That's track one. switched the presets, plays it, and so everything sounded really weird. And then all of a sudden, he lays his vocals, and it's like, ah, it warms it all up. Incredible that such a late moment in his career, such an odd method of production, got him the recognition he had long deserved already.
So lots of musicians are using the 808 at this point. It's become kind of, you know, acceptable. Are there any musicians who think, ugh, and sort of rejected it on those grounds that it's not true musicianship?
Yeah, of course. A lot of music publications at the time were slating the 808 as essentially the worst thing that ever came on the face of the earth, because it sounded like a march of ants essentially. And it became iconic because it was so far from mainstream at that time. It lived in nightclubs, the Fun House in New York, for example. These were the places where those records, produced in those odd, deviant way, if you want, were played and tested out. And yes, it definitely had a lot of people who were not interested because it looked like I don't need that. I'm above that, definitely. And it defined certain artists that broke their own ground. The Beastie Boys are a great example. Beastie Boys, their first album, License to Ill, all 808. An 808
But they were seen as sort of pranksters when they came out with that album, and the 808 kind of fits neatly into that narrative.
Absolutely. They were not necessarily even taken completely seriously.
No.
But then again, they had, they had Run DMC recording in the same studio, and every time they were doing something, for example, when Adam York reversed the beat for Paul Revere.
Here's a little story I got to tell about three bad brothers you know so well. It started way back in history with that rock and me.
My team. They ran, the guys from Run DMC ran in and just said, what is this? This is a hit. Whatever you do with this, this is going to be huge.
Did they use the 808 Run DMC?
No, actually, they used a lot of other drum machines. It's quite interesting that because as well it had a short lifespan. It disappeared after 3 years. So you can imagine that the new options started to come, and therefore, at the same time, it became harder to get, or people moved on for a while until people started to want to have that sound. The persistence took time to come. But the attachment to that sound was, those new drum machines, they work. Even the 909 that came soon after the 808, it worked. It worked well. It was not imperfect. And therefore, that's perhaps why having something imperfect invites creativity, because you're allowed to mess with it. If it's not perfect, it's not holy.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it became iconic because people got to do whatever the hell they wanted with it.
So that original 808 machine that Marvin Gaye used, you discovered, or someone who got that actual machine discovered, that those presets were still in place.
Yeah.
So when he bought the 808 machine, he turned it on, and there was Sexual Healing?
Absolutely. It was the band Soul Wax, also known as Too Many DJs.
Uh-huh.
And they went into a shop in Belgium. They are from Belgium originally. And they found an 808 that was for sale for 808 euros. And the guy in the shop was adamant, this is the one that was used by Marvin Gaye to do Sexual Healing, because we're not very far from Ostend, where it was recorded. And it's definitely the one. And the guys were like, okay, yeah, sure. You're just selling very hard right now. And they brought it back to their studio, plugged it in, turned it on. First setting on was the beat of Sexual Healing. And they were like, no way. So whether or not it was a pure coincidence, or that they had, or somebody programmed it to make the story, it definitely had its effect on them.
It's a good story.
Absolutely.
Let's just believe it.
Absolutely. I believe it.
Okay. Alex Neuer, executive producer for the new documentary 808. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on this program, we'll have your 10 best books of 2016. So stay tuned for that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The year is almost over. Maybe you've spent some time, a lot of time, binge-watching Stranger Things or Transparent or any number of TV offerings. And maybe you're ready to turn over a new leaf in 2017, or a new page, if you will. Well, the New York Times has put out its picks for the 10 best books of 2016, 5 novels and 5 nonfiction works to catch up on. They range from a novel about a Korean housewife who goes vegetarian to a memoir set in the chaos of Libya in 2012. Radhika Jones is editorial director of books for the New York Times, and she's here to share some highlights from her list. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, how do you guys whittle down all of the books? They're just 10.
It is, as you can imagine, quite a task. The best books list is drawn from books that we've reviewed over the course of the year, which puts the number in the high hundreds. And the staff editors at the book review, who are probably among the most passionate readers you will ever meet, are thinking about possible contenders basically from January 1st on. And so the books that feel like maybe they'll rise to the top are kept and circulated among the staff so everyone can get a look at them. There are a lot of robust conversations. So you can imagine the level of debate that goes on.
Yeah, I can imagine you're not shy there at the New York Times. Well, so it's
lots of opinions.
Yes, it seems like many of them are of the moment. And I know that, you know, to be a great work of art, you have to be timeless as well. But a lot of them seem to be of the political moment. And let me just highlight one of them that you could talk about. This is a fiction book. It's called The Association of Small Bombs. And I believe this is about the fallout from a terrorist attack in Delhi.
This is an incredibly moving novel. It opens with a terrorist attack in a Delhi market, a very crowded market. And among the number of casualties are 2 young boys, sort of middle school aged boys. And the novel follows the lives of the people who are affected by these deaths. Their parents, a friend of theirs who is with them but who is spared, and sort of all of the other people, the people who planted the bomb, and their colleagues. And it is a really engrossing look at something that happens a lot in journalism, which is the event happens and then people move on to the next event. This mm-hmm. novel is about, well, what happens when you don't move on, when this is the event that changes your life? And everything that happens after that sort of relates back to this terrible tragedy.
The book is called The Association of Small Bombs by Karan Mahajan. Another fiction offering that I'd love for you to highlight is a book called The Vegetarian. And this is about a Korean housewife who goes vegetarian. It sounds interesting.
There are some books that just make you miss your subway stop if you are a commuter in a subway city, and this was definitely one of those books for me. It's very simple on the face of it. A woman wakes up one morning and says to her husband, it's a little more dramatic than this, but basically the crux of it is, I'm no longer eating meat. And this becomes a kind of a series of cascading events that end up being devastating. It is enlightening about the ways that people's choices in their lives can have an influence on even those most elemental of relationships between husband and wife, between sister and sister, daughter and father, daughter and mother. It's a very close novel. It's a small cast of characters. You could say it's almost claustrophobic at times. It's very interior, but it's just absolutely mesmerizing.
The Vegetarian by Han Kong. Okay, so those are 2 of the fiction winners of the top 10 list, and you can check out the 3 others at the New York Times website. Let's get into nonfiction now. Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. That's by Jane Mayer of The New Yorker, and it's a about the Koch brothers, the product of a 5-year-long investigation. Do you see this book as more or less relevant now post the presidential election?
I think it's extremely relevant. And as you said, it's the product of 5 years of investigation. Jane Mayer is definitely an expert in this field, as well as being an incredibly well-established writer of nonfiction. And I think more and more the general public is aware of and interested in how politicians and movements are funded, where that money comes from, what agendas might be behind it. She is just an absolute master at pulling the curtain back on those processes.
Nonfiction, Evicted, Poverty, and Profit in the American City by Matthew Desmond. What's this book about?
Matthew Desmond moved into a Milwaukee trailer park in 2008 and then to a rooming house on the north side of that city, a poverty-stricken area. He was a graduate student in sociology, and he took notes on the lives of the people on the brink of eviction. And it's an incredible piece of extended reportage. And more than that, to me, this is a book about bearing witness to people whose lives we aren't often privy to, but who are suffering hugely in the current economy. And I think it's one of those works that is both highly specific, but also enables you to exercise a lot of empathy for people whose stories you might not otherwise have heard.
Yeah. All right, finally, let's talk about another nonfiction entry, The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between. And this is a memoir set in Libya in 2012 after the overthrow of Gaddafi. What is surprising in this book that we haven't heard, as we heard a lot about Benghazi during the campaign? What do you learn reading this book?
I mean, I think the noteworthy thing about this book is that it's a memoir from someone whose own family life was profoundly affected by the contemporary history of Libya. The author's father was a critic of Gaddafi. He was abducted in exile in 1990, and he disappeared. And so this is a memoir that reckons with that turn of events and, you know, is also a work of grief and mourning in a way for the author's father. So it's something that it's a sort of general area and topic that's in the news, but from a perspective that is both unique and incredibly personal.
What was your personal number one favorite book of 2016, if you could whittle it down to just one?
For me this year, that's an easier question than most years, and I will say The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, which is one of the fiction works on this list. Colson Whitehead has been an acclaimed writer for some time, but this book, which is about the history of slavery and of Black experience in America, is just brilliant on so many levels. The presiding metaphor of it is the Underground Railroad, which he reimagines as an actual thing, a real rail line underground that would transport escaped slaves to new places, not only in the American landscape, but also new places in American history. So through this kind of both space and time traveling device, he's able to tell these incredibly compelling stories about his protagonist, Cora, who's an escaped slave, and what happens to her and what happens to the people around her.
Radhika Jones, editorial director of books for The New York Times, and you can check out the full list at the New York Times website, the full 10. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Christian Bordahl is here now, sitting in for Julie Myers.
Hey there, Madeline.
Who is under the weather, sadly.
She is. It's a terrible shame, but we will get on with it anyway.
We will persevere, and hopefully exactly. She will too.
Yes, and hopefully she'll be back with us. Well, anyway, you talked earlier with Shani about Trump's tweet criticizing Chuck Jones. He's the union leader at the Carrier air conditioning plant. Since then, Jones has had death threats, other trolling. So we asked listeners, should Twitter pull the plug on Trump's account, or should he be able to tweet whatever he wants? People had a lot of opinions. Mo Switalski says when death threats are a result of his tweet, it's time to pull the plug on the man. Drew Stewart says the president has the right to free speech just as much as the rest of us. He's a U.S. citizen. Linda Nelson said, let him tank himself. Keep tweeting. George Benitez says, grow up, people. Get off your righteous soapbox. Jackless Camilla says, pull it. Umberto Capiro says, no censorship. He won fair and square. Get over it. Linda Contreras says, pull it. The guy's a 70-year-old internet troll. Bill Evans says, he's like a child that can't handle a privilege. Pull it.
Okay, we're going to pull you right now because we're running out of time. Okay. If you want to weigh in, at KCW Press Play. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.